Good afternoon. Can you hear me in the back? Welcome. You're in the right room if you came to hear the panel on governance and globalization. My name is Judy Samuelson. I am the executive director of the Business and Society Program at the Aspen Institute, and it's my pleasure to turn the session over to our moderator, Bob Hormats. Bob's a long friend of the Aspen Institute. He currently serves as vice chairman of Goldman Sachs International and managing director of Goldman Co. He is also the author of a recently released book that we had the great pleasure of featuring in a book talk in New York called The Price of Liberty, Paying for America's Wars from the Revolution to the War on Terror, which is a wonderful expose that is very relevant today. He, like all good people at Goldman Sachs, has moved back and forth between investment banking, trade, and government. And his favorite job, when I asked him, in government, of which he's held several, was serving as economic advisor to Kissinger on the National Security Council. So we're in good hands.
Hey, Bob. Well, first of all, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I will not spend a lot of time introducing the members of our panel, in part because they've all appeared in earlier panels. Let me just go from left to right. I don't know if that's appropriate, probably, but we'll see. our first, on my just to my immediate right is, well, go this way, is Austin Goolsbee, Robert Gwynn Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, who is also the Chief Economic Advisor to Senator Obama. Then our next speaker is Dave McCormick, U.S. Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs. Prior to that, after a career at West Point, jumping out of airplanes afterwards in various parts of the world, and then the White House and the Department of Commerce, has been really done a number of things in the government and is now in charge of dealing with the interesting issues of international financial policy. And Ben Heineman, a very old friend who is distinguished senior fellow, the program of legal profession, it's called, at the Harvard Law School, and importantly is the author of a new book, which also is on sale, called High Performance and High Integrity. And he's been talking about this on a number of panels as well. So we've got a different set of issues today. There have been a number of discussions of the global economy. What we're going to try to do in a relatively short period of time is discuss some of the structural and institutional issues that are involved. And just let me identify a few specific thoughts to set the stage. One, the world economy has changed a lot, even over the last 8 years or 7.5 years since George W. Bush took over as president. If you look at, for instance, the role of the emerging economies, they have grown dramatically. Their share of world GDP has grown dramatically. The United States is more dependent on them for their markets and for their capital and certainly for their oil and for their raw materials. Trade as a portion of U.S. GDP has increased substantially, and trade now is giving a big boost to the American economy, quite apart from what you might hear in the press. The trade is depressing growth. It's actually one of the stronger elements of American growth, the big increase in exports. And, of course, we're seeing in a country which has a chronically low savings rate, a great deal of money coming from the rest of the world, particularly into U.S. financial institutions, but into the capital markets in general, buying treasuries and buying corporate assets. So the world economy has changed. There are a lot of things that are changing. And what we're going to try to do in a relatively short period of time is to address several things. One, what can the United States do internally to rise to the new challenges posed by the global economy? And by challenges, I don't mean necessarily threats. I mean competitive challenges, but also enormous opportunities to take advantage of these growing markets and of the wealth that's built up in various parts of the world. So one is what we need to do internally. Second, what do we need to do to change the global system? That doesn't necessarily mean tinkering with the IMF or the World Bank or the WTO, but how do we improve cooperation around the world to deal with some of these newer issues, the energy issue, the environmental issue, which is very prominently featured at during these discussions, the issue of the spread of infectious disease. Avian flu was a big issue, not so much today, but it could come back. There are a whole range of these global economic, financial issues that go beyond the traditional institutions that were established after World War II. How can countries work together to deal better with those kinds of new issues? And the third, and I was prompted to add this because of Ben's excellent book, what do corporations, what does the private sector have to do internationally and domestically to adjust to these changes in terms of addressing environmental issues, addressing energy issues, sustainability, things of that nature. They're all part of the structural changes that need to be undertaken in the global system. And there's an opportunity here because we have a presidential election. Many of these issues are on the table, and we have people here who are very influential in the electoral process, but also in helping to establish the kinds of issues that the American public focuses on in the political process itself has to focus on, because they are so demanding and they're so new, and fresh approaches are not only welcome but necessary. So let me start out, Austin, like give you the floor. You can begin the process and give us your thoughts, and we'll go around, the panel will talk, give us its views, and then we'll discuss some of these amongst ourselves for a little while and then think up your questions, because we definitely want audience participation in the process.
Well, I was just going to try to keep it short. I thought getting to some dialogue might be good. I would, as an economist, step out of the political environment for a second. A couple of things are unusual. One, the basic model that most economists have in their mind of how the system would work is that developed countries would be sending capital to developing nations. That's the kind of natural progression of things. They've accumulated the capital. They would send it there as they develop, and then as they get rich, they would send capital. The last several years have been totally the opposite. I mean, why relatively poor countries are sending massive amounts of capital to the United States is a little unusual. A second point, the rise of the sovereign wealth funds is not a random event. As I look at that, if you're going to continue running major macroeconomic imbalances, what did you think was going to happen? I mean, if the money is accumulated, the price of oil is $145 a barrel, of course the guys who ship oil are going to start accumulating a lot of money. And if you run major trade deficits and have to borrow substantial amounts of money from abroad, of course the people you're borrowing money from are going to be accumulating big reserves and be looking around to try to figure out what to do with that. I think a lot of that, a lot of our focus we ought to put on the core issues of the domestic savings rate, which has continued falling, and for a couple of quarters, literally the personal savings rate went below zero. So if you added up all the savings of the American people combined, it was less than nothing. The domestic savings rate is important, and the government savings / our fiscal position is very important, because we're now in this situation where we're heavily, heavily dependent on borrowing from abroad to finance our investment at home. In a circumstance like that, it puts pressure on the dollar. It builds up these big accumulations of debt, and it really, I think, argues for trying to find a different way, because we know that this, having a world economy based on a bunch of massive imbalances where the Chinese are going to run huge surpluses with everybody and count on the U.S. running big deficits in return, I don't know how sustainable that is, either economically or politically.
Thanks. There's so many different facets of what you started with. Let me just try to make one significant point, which is that as we think about how we respond nationally to some of the challenges and the many trends you've said, I think we're at a real inflection point in terms of how the United States responds to globalization more broadly, and put the current economic challenges and anxieties and turmoil aside for a second, which is hard to do at the moment, I know. But just the backdrop of globalization has created enormous anxiety, enormous questions about how the United States can continue to have its economic, its economic leadership role in the world. And I think we're really at risk of turning inward at the exact time when we need to turn outward and engage with the world to be successful, to lead, to continue to be one of the most productive competitive economies in the world. And so I think the next president, whoever that might be, is going to need to lead a process which gets us to a new consensus on globalization and how the United States is going to maintain its competitiveness. And there's a number of different pieces of that, but I'll mention four very, very briefly, and we can develop them further if people would like. One is I think we need to have a different model for how we think about helping workers, helping employees transition in a much more dynamic world than we have today. And the old models, I think, are probably not going to be sufficient for the future, because all of us in today's economy change jobs and have to develop new skills at a pace that's far different than our parents or their parents. The second, I think we need to have a commitment on openness. Openness to trade, openness to investment, and capital in today's global markets is like water. It flows down the path of least resistance. That capital is critical to our competitiveness, and we need to have an environment that welcomes it. The third dynamic is that I think we need to have a focused effort on winning the global war for talent. And ultimately, we have a set of policies in place in our country. Put the whole immigration debate aside for a second, but a set of policies that dissuade, discourage, and ultimately send home many of the best and brightest engineers and scientists that are critical to our competitiveness. And then there needs to be an underlying focus on math and science and engineering that's sort of a core of American competitiveness, and there's lots of reasons to believe that our lead there is slipping. So those are components of a consensus. There are probably other components that needs to be developed. And if we don't develop that, I think we're not going to be able to address the anxieties of the American public. And ultimately, I think we're at risk for political reasons of going down a path that ultimately leads us to a less competitive America and one that's less open to the world.
Thanks.
Very briefly, before addressing the policy issues, I want to address the topic of the session, which is governance. And I would argue that the governance issues are critical for global corporations and that the two goals for global capitalism are high performance with high integrity. And by integrity, I mean robust compliance with the spirit and letter of rules, adoption of global ethical standards which go beyond what the law requires and bind the company and its employees, and most importantly, in the workforce, whether it's in India or the United States, Bangladesh or Indonesia, the values of honesty, fairness, candor, reliability, and trustworthiness. And you can't have those values unless you have basically respect and adherence to the law and unless the company adopts global ethical standards, which will become clear in each company what they need to do. Now, the importance of that is that at the core of capitalism, I think we have to accept our pressures for corruption. Capitalism is about making numbers, whether it's stock price, net, cash flow, product launch dates, whatever it is. At the core are pressures which, if unconstrained, cause people to fudge the numbers, to lie, to cheat, and not do it. So you have to basically have a system of governance inside great companies that recognize that and try to create a culture where both there's a negative side, if you're caught, you get punished, but much more importantly, creates an affirmative culture where people really want to do the right thing. I believe this is really essential in an age of globalization where there are going to be many critics of capitalism, there are going to be many critics of company. It is an imperative of this particular age. I won't go too much longer, but one of the things that I try to argue in the book, and indeed one of the things that sort of drove me to write the book, is that we have spent far too much time on the board of directors in talking about governance of great corporations. And I would add that the top 200 corporations have an enormous impact on world trade. GE is just one example. Has 320,000 employees, $200 billion of revenue plus or minus, $20 billion of profits and cash flow. We operate in 100 countries. If you just took our revenues, we would be in the top 15 in terms of GDP, if you made that analogy, which is imperfect, top 15 countries in the world, then multiply that by 200 like companies. You have a lot of influence. We have to be great global citizens, and to do that, we have to sort of fuse high performance with high integrity. The board of directors cannot do it, which is where all the governance's debate has been. Again, the topic of this session this afternoon, global governance. The person who has to do it is the CEO. And the CEO has to basically not only talk the talk, but has to drive the aspirations of the company into the company, into operations, through people, resources, systems and processes. And it's hard work, and it must be done. And I think that we ought to be having a debate on these great global companies of how they're managed across cultures and how you have best practices, and not less, much less time on what, how many meetings the directors ought to have and whether they're independent or not by some technical definition. But how do you really do this in great global enterprises? And so I would put to you that while certainly the institutional structure of the international system is terribly important, and I'm happy to discuss any of these policies, since so much of the drivers these days are these great corporations, and not just in the United States and not just in Europe, increasingly, as everyone knows, in India and China and elsewhere, we really have to understand how they are governed in a real way on the ground, down to the employee level, and not just at the board level.
Thanks. Let's follow up on a few thoughts. First of all, Austin made a very compelling point that a country with a very low savings rate that needs capital for its investment is going to have to get it from somewhere, and it's going to get it, as we are now, from countries that have a very high savings rate. And who are those countries? You know, China and a lot of the oil and commodity producers. So the question emerges, what do we do as a country that has become used to cheap credit in part as a result of a lot of capital coming from abroad, and cheap energy, which we're 60% dependent on for the oil exporting countries? What kind of changes do we need to make internally in order to reverse that, or at least reduce those kinds of imbalances? Because I think you're right, as long as we do that, we're going to be very dependent. And then we get to the point that Dave made, and that is we're going to turn more and more inward if the United States can't develop a greater sense of self-confidence and it feels totally beholden to the rest of the world. And in fact is, because we can't generate the savings or the energy we need to meet our own needs. What kind of policies are going to be required to address those kinds of issues down the road?
I mean, on energy, we know that it's a lot of conservation, investing in alternative energy and stuff that gets a little bit out of the direct economic sphere. On credit, do you think credit is expensive? I mean, some people are arguing the real interest rate is negative.
No, I'm saying cheap credit. We've gotten used to cheap credit.
We have gotten used to cheap credit,
right.
But it's not at all clear that we don't still have cheap credit. I'm saying the real interest rate now is maybe it's negative.
I agree.
So I'm not exactly sure how that plays out. I don't, in a way that's different from oil. With oil, thus far, there are many reasons to expect that we're transitioning to an era where oil is going to be relatively scarce. The capacity is this, demand is growing. With credit, that's not obvious to me. Mm-hmm. Especially if the U.S. started to increase its own savings rate. I mean, it seems like we would have the potential to continue to have cheap credit once we get out of a sort of a crunch period.
But we wouldn't be as dependent on foreigners to provide it.
That's true.
Difference.
Go ahead. I was going to make a different slightly.
I was just going to say, I think there was a great discussion this morning that Austin was part of, which is, you know, we need to go in a good old-fashioned saving plan where deficit spending is eliminated and we address entitlements. And that's easier said than done. Everybody agrees with that. The question is, how do you do that? The second point on energy, I think there's something that's important to internalize here, which is this is a problem which has taken quite a number of years to develop, and it's not one that unfortunately lends itself to quick fixes. The price of commodities and the prices of energy in particular are placing a real burden on families, a real burden on the U.S. economy, a real burden on the global economy, and unfortunately there's going to be a number of things we're going to need to do that are going to have effects, but there'll be medium-term effects. So on the supply side, there's a whole series of things that need to happen both at home and globally around further investment in terms of energy infrastructure and investment in alternative fuels. And on the demand side, there's things we need to do at home, namely conservation, but also eliminating some of the subsidies that exist around the world. So part of what we see is this enormous demand in energy that's being driven by the emerging market growth, which is in general a very positive thing, that dynamic growth we see in their economies. But the energy growth that is resulting is disproportionate because of the fact that the majority of those emerging economies have subsidies in place. And those are, over time, unaffordable for them and certainly have driven the energy markets in a much more accelerated pace than they would have moved otherwise.
Just on a slightly different thing, but relating the sort of the corporate interest to the broad governmental interest, we've had a 50-year debate about development and whether economic come first or institutions come first. I think there's sort of a consensus that they have to come together, but we don't know how. I think we also know that we can't do it from the United States. We cannot force countries to develop, or the developing world can't do it. The developed world can't do the development. And yet, the rule of law, the institutional infrastructure, has to be coupled with sort of economic growth, or the margins and the ability to do business there are not going to exist. People talk, multinationals talk about 60% of their business being in emerging markets. But if you look at the margins in those markets, they're much less than they are in other societies because of all the difficulties with corruption and irregularities and the enormous problems that exist in places like China and even in India. Yeah. And so I think one of the hidden issues where we really need to be cooperative, we need to be creative, is how do we really think about development in these countries now which have lots of money, but lots of other problems, and are not really part of the system. You know, we can talk about China, as Bob Zoellick did, as a stakeholder, but what does it really mean, and what are they really doing? And I think this development question is embedded in all the issues that we're talking about.
Well, let's switch then to the question of what we need to do internally to give ourselves the confidence that we can compete in the global economy, because we're not going to get support for an open trading system if Americans are insecure about their
jobs. If you want to go back to
jobs.
I'm going to say one word. Let me just say what David said. I said this yesterday in the same group. Labor markets are the key to the controversies about globalization. And so I think, but sort of churn in the labor markets in the United States is not due to globalization alone. In fact, globalization may be a very small part of it. But we may need to rethink what we do about unemployment, transition education, all these things. I think a great issue will be a relook at all those issues in the coming years to allay the fears of people who are being displaced, whether it's by technology, productivity, or globalization.
That's the thing. People are anxious about their jobs, and when they're anxious about their jobs, they're more reluctant to go along with open trade. So why don't we discuss this? David mentioned a few thoughts on that. Do you want to elaborate a little bit more and then have Austin and Ben talk about it? Because I think unless we can deal with this insecurity, which, as you say, Ben, is not largely caused by trade, there's a lot more churn. Technological change is a major source, a much greater source. But nonetheless, people feel this, and it's impossible, in my judgment, to get most trade legislation through the Congress today. NAFTA would not pass today, almost certainly. So unless we can deal with some of these issues of self-confidence and ease of adjustment of jobs and energy and training and education, we're going to find it very difficult to get more support. So let's dwell on this for a moment.
Yeah, just a few points, and then I'll turn it to them. I think this is one of those cases where the underlying analytics and the underlying policy is relatively clear. The politics are very challenging. So I think most mainstream economists would agree that trade has had a net positive benefit. If you look just at the 15 free trade agreements we have in the United States, those exports to those countries have grown at twice the rate of exports to other countries. 95% of the customers in the world live outside the United States. There's a basic logic in us, particularly in a globalized world, being a trading country that relies increasingly on selling to the rest of the world. In the case of investment, if you look in the United States today, about 10 million jobs can be attributed to foreign investment in the United States. And interestingly enough, those investments or those jobs pay on average 25% more than U.S. firms, and their percentage of dollars they put back into research and development is higher on average than other firms. So this is from an analytics standpoint, it's a net benefit, I think, and most people would agree. The problem is that sometimes those benefits are unevenly spread. And so how do you make the case for a broad-based benefit to our country that I would argue only becomes more important as time goes by in a situation where politically there's misunderstanding in some cases, in some cases there's true disruption? And how do you put together a policy outcome that addresses some of the legitimate concerns but doesn't leave the enormous benefits of openness to the United States on the table at a time when we need them most?
Austin.
I sort of have two or three short reactions to that. And one, I hope I'm not violating what all economists agree on, but on one hand, it's clear there has to be a domestically sustainable trade policy, domestically sustainable policy toward openness in global markets. I think that the efforts in that area have to go well beyond just training and trade adjustment assistance and things of that nature. Ultimately, the lack of a coherent health system and having almost 50 million people with no insurance and a bunch of people who have insurance getting sick and then dropped. I mean, the failures of our health system are really fundamentally, although totally domestic in origin, they fundamentally affect people's views toward whether they want to take the risks of going out in the global marketplace. Investing in the long-run skills of our people, the educational system, and investing in the science and technology and industries of the future, some of those clearly in alternative energy, but also in high technology and science. I agree all of those are important. And I would point out, I think it absolutely cuts to the core of the issue of domestic sustainability that people that want to be opponents can look at trade agreements and they're riddled with loopholes and they can see the operation of special interests in the making of our trade policy. I think that deeply undermines the case that people, you can make the case, we're just trying to be open. But then when you go through these 1,000-page documents and they look like the tax code, people say, well, wait a minute, are you really about openness and doing what's good for the country, or are you trying to protect the interests of this campaign donor or these people who have paid money for lobbying? And I think that's a very serious issue. And the way I say it is, that's very different from are you for trade or not for trade. And so if your kitchen is terrible and you hire a contractor to come fix up your kitchen, and they do it, but you find along the way your contractor was stealing money from you, look, you're still better off to have your kitchen. But that doesn't make you any happier about the fact that they were stealing money. And it does make it more likely that your neighbor is going to say, you know what, I don't want to bother to fix up my kitchen if the guy's going to rip me off. And that's kind of the same way with free trade agreements. Free trade is good. It's good for the country. Overall, we're better off. But you can't deny that if you go open up the free trade agreements, the contractor's pocketing money on the side. And we got to think about that issue. The last thing that I would raise is the concerns that people in manufacturing have had. You can fall prey to the argument which says, hey, manufacturing's going down, the jobs are gone, and they're not coming back, and you just should get used to it. But before you say that, remember, we've got these massive imbalances which have led to a situation, and our currency going down, which would normally be building up manufacturing and increasing exports in the U.S., which has happened a bit. But when you got countries like China just systematically devaluing to stay with us so that they don't close any of these gaps, there I think it's a little more complicated, because there is a perfectly good argument to be made for U.S. manufacturing companies to say, well, look, if we pursue currency policies, or if we pursue macroeconomic policies that have this impact on our currency, manufacturing would be better. There would be more our overall level of output might be the same, but we would have more manufacturing jobs. We would be more oriented toward exports than we are now. And I think that's a valid, that's a valid concern.
Ben, from the
just
corporate
make sector, one observation as a former Carter administration official a long time ago. I think one of the great challenges for whatever administration shows up in Washington is this tension between comprehensive and incremental. It's one of the oldest policy arguments anyone ever has. President Carter, as many of you may remember, was a big fan of comprehensive programs. The only problem with the programs is he put too many forward and they were politically too controversial. And he basically, at the end of his first year, his credibility was significantly injured, and he had a hard time effectively governing thereafter. So, to your first question, Bob, about workers, you're certainly correct that there are many factors that are critical to assess. The hard question, I think, for any president, the most important question, is going to be what are the two or three agenda items that are at the very top because any president can only really do that. If there's overload a la Carter and grandiosity a la Carter, nothing will happen. And so what is doable and desirable on the top three in this area, or in all the areas, I think is really the critical question, because I acknowledge everything you say, but I'm not sure it all can be done at once.
Well, let me ask you a question then about the corporate sector. There are a lot of companies in the corporate sector that are free trade, but are they doing enough internally to address the training needs and the education needs?
Well,
and
I apologize to those who were here yesterday, GE a long time ago, as a company, recognized that for restructuring globalization, we had to. But if you're talking about companies, right, as opposed to social policy or economic policy, companies themselves have to recognize it, that it's a price they have to pay. And so I think enlightened companies will do it if they have the balance sheet. But the question, Bob, is beyond the great behemoths, there's a lot of churn anyway.
Sure.
And what do you do about that?
Well, the other thing, the point that Austin made, having been Deputy U.S. Trade Representative, one of the points that Austin raised is a very valid one. These agreements are not really free trade agreements. If you're a powerful company and you want a free trade agreement with so-and-so, you're also trying to get some interest of yours protected in that agreement. And that does undermine the credibility of some of those agreements. I'm not saying this is a GE issue. It's a broader issue. But it has undermined the credibility because, in a way, it's sort of a corporate subsidy in the sense that...
It's like the tax code.
Yes, it's like the tax code, riddled with people who say, well, I want the tax level to be such and such, but not for this particular point, a component of my business. And it does mean that they're not really... Even a free trade agreement that's called one is a very selective free trade agreement with some benefiting and some not. Is the corporate sector that does generally want trade agreements willing to be a little bit, shall we say, more restrained in asking for these special benefits? Or is this just the inevitable nature of the way trade and tax law and other things are conducted in Washington that's not going to change?
I am certainly not going to sit in front of this intelligent audience and speak for the corporate sector.
Intuition.
I don't think one can generalize. I think if they saw that the bill had to be... And we did get tax reform in the mid-'80s against all odds where...
The 86 bill.
Yeah, right.
They did give up some of the perks.
Right. So I think a lot of it depends on a new politics, which is much discussed, and how clear these issues can be to the general public and how willing the Congress is not to have Gucci Gulch repeated. And I can't, sitting here today, I can't tell you that those conditions are going to be met, but that's the kind of thing that the president has to create the momentum that basically blows that stuff out of the water.
All right. We've had a discussion amongst...
Can I make a comment?
Sure,
Just quickly. I would just make three very brief points. One is that there's been at least a two-decade consensus on free trade, where we have, under the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, have promoted free trade agreements. While no agreement's perfect, and certainly all of them can be better, I think it would be fair to say, and if others disagree, please highlight it, that our free trade agreements, as a general rule, are more rigorous and more comprehensive than any others struck around the world between other countries. And it comes down to the question of whether you're committed to free trade and open investment and then trying to figure out how to incrementally get there more effectively, or whether you start with a different premise on we need to improve these before we can be open to trade and investment. And the reason I highlight that is the world has typically looked to us as the beacon of openness, as the model. And we have typically had the moral high ground in terms of promoting openness. And there's lots of people watching. And this is by no means meant to suggest this is a partisan issue. I think it's a national issue, and there are people on both parties that are openly debating this. And I think the case for openness and the case for signaling we're less than open really has profound consequences.
Should we go to the audience? Yes, please. In the turquoise, the lady in the turquoise.
Okay. How do we get it back, rein it back in, and maybe when they
I think it's our responsibility to whoever's drawing up the documents to really hold ourselves accountable and the people we're trading with accountable for some basic things that all human beings, like we have in our contract.
Thank you. Who would like to?
Seems like you might have some insights on that one.
Thank you. You know, I'll try a little bit of it. It's a very interesting question. I think there is a role for Congress in doing just what you say, because in many cases, what I think we all want is rules-based trade. And there are many trade agreements where the rules are laid out but are not faithfully implemented, in some cases by us, and in other cases by other countries. And I do think it's important to go and review trade agreements periodically to find out if the letter and the spirit of the agreement are in fact being lived up to, and if they're not, to take the necessary adjustments and remedies in terms of American law or WTO legislation. There are frequent cases where this is not done, and I do think the credibility of existing agreements would be enhanced if we did more of it. I agree with that. Additional questions?
Yeah.
Yes, please. Yeah, go to, there's a mic. Oh, sorry. Start. Yes, we'll do it. But please line up at the microphone. Yes.
The United States has what's known as a two-tier tax system. Taxes the corporation and it taxes the shareholders on dividends. Generally speaking, the remainder of the modern world has an integrated tax system. It is argued, therefore, by U.S. multinationals that we are at a competitive disadvantage. Do you, as a panel, each individual's view of integrating our system, is that a worthwhile thing to do? And if so, how would you go about paying for it?
Who would like to take that on? Mr. Secretary?
Well, thank you. Just a brief point on this. I'm by no means the tax expert, but I do have a lot of interaction with our global companies, and I do think there's been an enormous shift, which I referred to earlier, which is that the ability of companies to move internationally and the ability of capital and investment to flow with freedom that it's never had in the past means that we are competing. We are competing for capital. We are competing for companies to come to the United States. And to the extent that our corporate tax code is not competitive with other countries around the world, then I think that ultimately undermines our competitiveness and undermines our tax base and undermines a number of other things that are important for a growing dynamic economy. And if you, just as a point of reference, look to some of the European economies, which have typically not been the models that we subscribe to in terms of our tax system, but many of them have significantly reduced their corporate tax rate because they've recognized this. And the United States, which at one point I think was viewed as the top decile, top percentile in terms of corporate taxes, now has fallen much lower on that scale. I think the World Bank does these doing business indicators, which measures the different economies around the world relative to a consistent set of measures. And our competitiveness on corporate tax code has dropped dramatically, not because we've changed it for the worse, but because others have changed it for the better. So I don't have a specific view on integration. I do have a view on the need to continue to evolve that to ensure we're competitive with the rest of the world. How you pay for it is in ultimately the fact that if we're attracting corporations, if we're growing, their tax base is bigger and ultimately presents us with the revenues we need to support it.
I would say on the corporate side, corporate income tax rate side, this is a very tough, difficult issue because on one hand, our tax rate, as stated in the book, is the second highest of all the rich countries of the world. But if you look at the actual tax rates paid, ours is one of the very lowest, the fourth lowest of all the OECD, which tells you we're doing a lot of things in our corporate tax code other than just charging them what the stated tax rate is. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of that is from investment incentives, trying to get companies to invest in the U.S. Some of it is clearly from playing international transfer pricing as a tax tax planning, what they euphemistically call tax planning activities. Outright cutting the corporate rate is immensely expensive to do. And if your main goal is to steer investment or to make a country competitive, you do a lot more than just that, cutting the corporate rate. You end up giving a lot of big windfalls to people. So that's an issue you got to think about. Corporate integration as a concept is one. I'd be happy to have a discussion with you about it. It comes out of the academic community, and there's a lot of debate about it. There is a fear of fully moving to corporate integration, meaning there would be no corporate income tax. Everything would be taxed at the individual level. There is a fear that the massive differential between corporate and personal rates would potentially open up the system to other kinds of tax sheltering behaviors of people being able to classify their income in one form or the other, which are at least worth thinking through before you're going to adopt it.
Ben, you want
to? Well, I would only comment that people talk about corporate profits. The amount that goes to the fat cats, and the amounts are too big, is a fraction of that amount. In most big companies, it goes to shareholders, and shareholders are not just arbitrageurs. They're pensioners. There are a lot of people who deserve the dividend. The other half basically goes to develop the company, to R&D, to new markets, to whatever it is. So an interesting question is, if you did, in fact, lower the rate and had more greater profit, quote, unquote, rather than tax, what would it be used for? And would it be used for competitiveness and investment? I'm not competent today to answer that, but I do know that if you look at corporate profits, despite the fact that they're attacked all the time, the uses of them go to people and to R&D and to new products. They don't go to fat cats, except for a tiny percentage, and it's too much.
Yes, please.
Thanks, Bob. Laura Lauder from San Francisco. My first question is to Austin. How can we support farming price supports for domestic farmers? And then I would ask David, how can we not support and demand environmental and labor standards in our trade agreements?
For agriculture policy is outside of my, in the campaign, is outside of my purview. So all I know about our farm bill I get from talking to people or reading in the newspaper. I think the one thing about the level of subsidies, there are problems. The other is the differential nature of subsidies. Certain crops get big subsidies and a bunch of things get no subsidies. I mean, it does strike me as an area that's rife for a lot of reform, but I really don't know very much about it, so I can't be of more detail than that.
Can I answer Austin's question? No. On the labor standards, the environmental standards, there was a lot of discussion around this last spring. And in May of last spring, there was an agreement reached, a bipartisan agreement with members of the Congress and the administration on more robust language around environment and labor standards in the free trade agreements. And that has been incorporated into the free trade agreements that are now under consideration.
But Senator Obama has asked to reopen NAFTA to do exactly that, and he has been roundly criticized by the administration and others.
Well, I think to come back to the points I made earlier, this free trade environment is going to continue to evolve. I'm not here to tell you that there can't be improvements in free trade agreements and that there aren't some of the challenges that others have highlighted. I'm simply to say that the benefits are indisputable and that we need to continue to pursue them. And by reopening existing free trade agreements that have already been negotiated, I think you really begin to call into question the word of the United States and the commitment that we have to living up to our the agreements that we've already made. So that's dangerous and somewhat risky ground to be on, in my view.
Yes, please.
I have a friend who runs kind of a mid-size manufacturing firm, and he was recently telling me that with the devaluation of the dollar, he finds himself for the first time really able to compete with his competitors in Asia, but that his biggest barrier to growth is finding the sort of middle-skilled individuals able to take the family-supporting jobs at his factory. And so I'm curious to hear y'all's comments on that, and particularly not so much about creating a pipeline of workers by reforming our K-12 system, But, you know, moving forward, 3/4 of the workers who are going to be in the workforce 20 years from now are in the workforce today. So how do you all propose increasing the skills of today's workers so that we can continue to compete?
Ben, you've talked about that a bit. Do you want to discuss this?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, a big company like GE is not in the skills training program. We worked in disadvantaged communities to try to increase the number of kids graduating from inner city schools. That's not going to solve the problem. That is just a small drop in the bucket. I'm not an expert on elementary and secondary, so I can't answer except to acknowledge the validity of the point.
One of the prize unsung heroes of our educational system has been the community college network around the country. They have proven extraordinarily effective at getting the very skills that the employers want to students who are not, you know, it's not four-year college students. It's not whatever. Frequently, it's very practical skills-based training, and it's not just for young people. A lot of times you see middle age and even approaching retirement people coming back to get skills. I think using that existing network is actually fairly important if you want to at all have a chance to do something in the near term, because dreaming up a new educational and training system could be good for the long run, but over the next 3 or 4 years, I mean, you kind of have to work through the channels you have. It is because of this belief that that's been a successful model. In Obama's education and skills program, he's put forward several things to use the transition of community college and job skills. So, for example, the community colleges want to provide computer training to anyone and have the resources and the computers to do it. And businesses say they would like to hire people who have computer training. And through just some regulatory and a little bit of money, but mainly some rules, they weren't allowed. So one thing in Obama's program is, let's open up and give free computer training to anyone that wants it at through the community college system. I think things like that are actually fairly important.
Yeah. Just one further point there. I mean, if you look at the way the American workforce is changing, almost half of the new entrants to the workforce over the next 10 years will be minorities or immigrants or children of immigrants. There's a huge increment in the American workforce, and training in those groups has been notoriously lagging in many parts of the country. And therefore, if we're going to have a competitive workforce and enable companies of the kind you've described to get good people, the training emphasis on that segment of the population is going to have to be enhanced quite dramatically. Otherwise, we'll be less competitive globally, and a lot of companies won't have the people they need. It's a critical area. It's a very good question. Yes, please.
I wanted to ask the panel, and particularly Austin, a question that's been troubling me on the savings rate that y'all were discussing. Because, Austin, you make an argument that sounds effective, which is the middle class faces this squeeze between dormant wage growth and increasing costs that drives a lower savings rate. And I wonder whether you or the members of the panel really believe that. I mean, the experiment we have with government rebates right now, where we pay the middle class $600, they, in fact, don't save it or pay off their credit cards. They go to Best Buy and buy TVs. I wonder whether our problem with the lower savings rate now versus, say, the 1950s is that we have a cultural problem. We have an instant gratification. It's not so much that people are squeezed. It's that they don't like to sacrifice and plan for the future. Do you think that a change in the tax code will change that behavior?
I used to live right next to this guy in school. This is a tough family. You know, it really put you on the spot. Good to see you again, Bill. Look, the thing is, the economic theory would tell you that a temporary change to your income and a permanent change to your income ought to have different effects on what people's behavior, as well as one are just purely economic things and one are, let's call them, cultural and psychological factors. I think we have been a little too prone, though I'm not disputing that there are some elements, to blame people, say we're slothful, we don't work hard enough, we have a culture of consumption that we spend everything we earn. The reason I think we've put too much weight on that is the savings rate's been cut by a factor of 4 over the last 12 years or so. And my impression of the impact of culture is it doesn't behave in anything like that kind of speed. Okay, so I think there are fundamental factors that have driven our personal savings rate from around 10% a little over a decade ago to zero today, and that those are centered in some of these unpredicted aspects of the middle class squeeze for about half the country in the middle was not expected. There was no reason to expect that middle class incomes would become stagnant. And so they had a level of spending that was based on the historic patterns of how incomes were doing in the middle of the distribution, which fundamentally shifts over a period of time in the last 6 or 8 years. Going forward, if that continues for good, you would expect people are going to have to ratchet down their standards of living. I would like to think we don't get into a... The goal of our policy should be to up the ante rather than the you'll get nothing and like it approach, which we have to tend more to... As you tend toward the cultural explanation, it's more like, well, get used to disappointment. That's kind of the policy prescription. And I don't actually think that that's... personally, I don't think that's the accurate descriptor of how we got to this. I think it's because we had these unexpected changes to incomes and some on costs. Healthcare increases were somewhat expected, but energy wasn't and food wasn't, and there are some others.
This will be our last question, please.
I come from Costa Rica, and we follow the American election closely. One thing we care about is trade. And as you mentioned, David, you know, over the past two administrations, I mean, two presidents, last two presidents, trade has been promoted. Even from many sympathizers of Senator Obama, there is a concern about what the position is going to be. And we understand rhetorics and, you know, we're in the middle of an election. But I would like to hear some comments on what the policy is going to be. Clearly, trade agreements can be improved, for sure. But does it mean that we're not going to have any until they are sufficiently improved? Or because many countries are still, you know, trading with the U.S. extensively in Latin America based on this preferential access to the U.S. market. So I would like to hear some comments on that.
Thank you.
I think it was directed.
Definitely directed.
I do not have clairvoyance, and I don't know exactly what it is. If you're asking what is Senator Obama's position, I can give you specific positions about trade agreements, about the importance of trade, but the need to have domestically sustainable trade and try to root out the power of special interests. To take a step back, though, I do want to reiterate, the United States has been a model of openness, and in some cases, it's been helpful for us, and in other cases, it's clear there have been countries that have taken advantage of our desire to lead the world in openness. And so it's a bit like the take a penny, leave a penny dish, and that's meant to just make the transactions easier, but if everybody just comes in and scoops out the pennies every time you put pennies in there, that system's not going to be sustainable. And so I understand that there are many countries of the world, maybe Costa Rica, who want privileged access to U.S. markets. Everybody has to be mindful of the fact that U.S. trade policy must be domestically sustainable and that we can't run gigantic imbalances with other countries of the world who, if they're going to express no desire to try to bring these things into balance or to they just say, yes, we like that the U.S. has been running its currency at this spot because it allows us to massively have export-led growth and the U.S. will just take everything we ship. There are issues. We have to address those issues. Now, Senator Obama supported, for example, the free trade agreement with Peru that goes through. He's opposed some of the current agreements that are up for various reasons. If they didn't do enough to open markets for U.S. products, or if there are other political considerations, it's entirely possible. He has repeatedly and consistently said he favors trade and that access to the fast-growing markets of the world is important for U.S. industry. So I believe that if we are mindful of the domestic sustainability of our trade policy, it's entirely feasible we have more trade agreements. And I would just take a step back. We have the WTO. We have an established trading system. There is a great deal of trade that takes place in the world that we don't need to find special privileged access for one particular country to U.S. markets for us to engage in massive amounts of very productive bilateral trade between countries. And I hope we would support and follow through on a lot of the promises that were made from the WTO.
I think our time is up. It's 2:15. I want to thank our panel for a terrific discussion.